This is the Reading Envy Podcast, where we'll have what you're reading.
Hello, this is Jenny, and today in the corner of the Reading Envy Pub, I am here with Darren Bradley. Hello, Darren.
Hello, Jen.
Thank you for coming and being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting me.
So Darren wears a lot of hats. You are an author, first and foremost, I imagine, a writer. And most recently known for the publication of Chimpanzee.
Correct.
Is that the most recent thing that's been published? You said you had some short fiction recently, too?
Yes, Chimpanzee came out last fall. That's the most recent thing. I didn't put out any short fiction in 2014. I kind of took a break.
Oh, okay.
And, I've written a couple of new things, and they're out, you know, throwing elbows and doing what they do to try to be published right now. So we'll see. Maybe in the next few months I'll have something to share.
Yeah. And then prior to Chimpanzee, there was the novel Noise.
Yes.
Okay. So then there's the writer hat.
Yeah.
And what else do you do?
Well, by day, my full-time job, what I get paid for is I'm an acquisitions editor at Resurrection House. So I read and acquire, you know, buy books. I'm involved in the copy editing and the line developmental editing and the marketing, you know, distribution. We have other team members who handle other aspects of that, but that's what pays the bills. And for them, I do a lot of cover design. I've always kind of been a dilettante designer on the side, and when they found out I could do that and it was a lot cheaper than paying someone else, I started doing a lot more internal cover design. So I spent a lot of my time, you know, reading submissions and designing covers for things that we've acquired. And occasionally, if, you know, on good behavior, I'm allowed to go out to conventions and you know, drink on the company dime and, you know, shake hands and stuff. So
sounds like a fun job.
Yeah. Other than that, you know, we just recently revived an old e-zine of mine that I shared with a couple of friends, Aaron Lease and Mike McConnell, were co-founders, and we got that started back in 2007. We ran it for a few years and then couldn't afford it, so we folded it. It's been 5 years, and I made a deal with Resurrection House to bring it back. So I'm editor-in-chief of that. And
it has an interesting name.
It does, yeah. It's not really supposed to mean anything. People have often asked us that, but a farrago is just kind of like a medley or a mixture, you know, and I was reading, I think it was one of John Clute's encyclopedias of fantasy back when I was working on my dissertation, and he talked about wainscot fiction, which was like these sort of interstitial slipstream stories, you know, between worlds, and I was just kind of struck by the idea of somebody actually called Farrago, and this kind of, you know, that's all we published was weird slipstreamy stuff, so we just kind of, yeah, smashed it together, and it stuck, and there's this whole identity of old man Farrago that grew out of it, and yeah, so it was pretty popular, and we didn't quite realize how popular it was when we closed it. And so when we brought it back, there was some applause, and we've raised our rates. And so yeah, we're, you know, it's a more legit operation now.
That's great.
Yeah, and it's a sister publication of another journal called Bahamut that I'm co-editing with my wife, who's a scholar of feminist, post-colonial, and you know, Arabic world literature. And that's going to be a biannual print journal that's more political, more like aggressive fringe political fiction, and a little less speculative. So, yeah, you know, when I'm not doing any of those things.
I know, I'm excited about both of those. So, will they come out only in print?
Bahamut will only be in print, and it will release a couple of its articles online, just, you know, for teasers. Mm-hmm. Farrago's Wainscot is primarily electronic. It comes out on the web every quarter. We just released an issue on the 14th, and the year after each year is done, they'll be collected into an omnibus edition for people who'd rather just hold the book of what we did that year.
Oh, great idea.
Yeah.
I'm one of those types of people who tends to wait till they're compiled like that. So.
Oh, yeah. I'm actually horrible at reading things on the internet. And I think we have two or three e-readers here in the house, but they're all my wife's and I don't even use them. I just don't think to do it, you know?
Yeah. I feel like I only read on e-readers if that's the only option.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hold it. I still want to hold it in my hands.
I will read submissions. I have a Surface. I'll read submissions on that thing because it gets me away from the desk so I can go sit on the couch and I can insert notes and stuff like that. But that's the closest thing I get to an e-reader.
Yeah. So if you have to read so much for work, do you still find pleasure in reading outside of work?
I do, but I read almost typically different material.
Yeah, I imagine you'd have to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, work is all, you know, speculative fiction. Some of it's straight sci-fi, straight fantasy. Some of it's horror. Some of it's slipstream. You know, Farrago's is all of those things in short chunks, and I have two editors who help me with it. But it's just, you know, the volumes are incredible. So when I can find the time to read, I tend to read a little bit more literary, or at least, you know, literary-leaning spec fic than I do, like, straight science fiction. I commonly have to lean on my coworker Misty, our production manager, who is just, you know, an encyclopedia of science fiction knowledge, and she'll go on some book and I've never heard of it, and you know, without her, I would appear a complete dunce. So, yeah,
but still speculative. Like, you're not jumping outside the genre or anything.
You know, in a manner of speaking, I mean, like, for example, you know, over the winter break, I finished Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation. Right?
Oh, so good.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's weird, but it's also, you know, that's not core genre. I think it's pretty clear to people who've read it. That's fringe, you know.
Sure.
And but before that, I read James Salter's Light Years. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it is a incredibly lyrical, you know, literary fiction. It got an introduction by Richard Ford. I think it was written in let me look here, 70s or 80s, and I'm really late to the game. But just one of the most beautiful lyrical books I've ever read, and it has nothing in common with science fiction. I mean, just absolutely not. It's, you know, straight literary fiction.
Yeah.
So I kind of swing back and forth, you know.
I'm kind of in that same place. I may read some things that clearly are not at all, but
yeah.
Like, I'm in the middle of Dahlgren right now.
Uh-huh.
By Samuel R. Delaney. Yeah. Chip.
Yeah.
And I used that word slipstream earlier. Some of us have been kind of calling it that because it's not science fiction. I mean, not really.
Yeah, I mean, science fiction, you know, speculative fiction is such a mushy term.
It is.
So, you know, a lot of the things that it just does, it has these kind of amoebic borders. It doesn't really have clear definitions. And, you know, slipstream, it's fun to hear people throwing that around again because, you know, that was really hot, like in 2001 to 2009. And then it kind of, things died off and cyberpunk, I mean, steampunk became really popular and kind of like the genre pendulum swung a little more conservative. And now people are kind of coming back, you know, to the weird interstitial. I think it's fun to watch those motions back and forth.
Yeah, and like this one's from the 70s, so
yeah.
I guess it comes back around.
Yeah, I mean, I say that, and you know, the book I'm working through right now, Don DeLillo's The Names, you know, that thing's 20 years old. But right after that is Daryl Gregory's After Party, which just comes, you know, highly recommended, and that is, you know, that's science fiction. So, I mean, you know, I'm kind of guilty of both, I guess.
Yeah.
It's really what people recommend to me. I don't often go hunting for books anymore. It's when someone freaks out and says, you have to read this or you're an idiot. And I'm like, oh, all right, fine. I'll put it on file, you know. But
that's a good way to go.
Yeah.
I know you. So who do you consider slipstream from, like, the 2001? Like, what do you think of? Who do you think of when you think of that?
My favorite writer was Kelly Link. I mean, she still is.
Yeah. And she has more stories coming out this year, I think.
Yeah. She stays really active, and you know, she and Jeffrey Ford, you know, there's even some work by Jonathan Lethem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, people point to, you know, China Mieville, but, you know, he sometimes distances himself from that idea.
Yeah.
But, you know, of the new weird and all of that. But, you know, there were great anthologies like Feeling Very Strange and Trampoline and Conjunction 39 that were just filled with these bizarre little lyrical stories. And those guys, yeah, I followed them really closely. I wrote about some of them, you know, studied them as best I could. And that's sort of how I got hit by that slipstream bug. And, you know, it's fun to teach. I taught it for a while, you know, at a few different places. And
yeah,
because usually the kids read it, you know, and like, what on earth is this? And, you know, teaching them not to pay attention to, you know, linearity or meaning, and instead to look at, like, how do these strange elements resonate together, you know, for more of an emotional impact. And, you know, it's really fun to see them start reading outside of the kind of cult of the plot driven book that everybody's kind of taught to appreciate, you know?
Yeah. I bet it's a hard challenge for them at some points.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I don't do it anymore. It was at the time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think with the one I'm reading now, I don't know, would you call Dahlgren slipstream? The group I'm reading it with, we're kind of playing around with that word. We're not really sure what it is, I think.
Slipstream or, you know, interstitial, you know, any of those categories that's sort of, you know, I mean, and the fact that the book is as old as it is, I mean, what it was accomplishing, you know, that kind of makes me think, like, I don't know if you've ever read any Alfred Bester. Have you read any of him?
Mm-mm.
You know, he wrote a lot of stuff in the 50s, and it's just mind-blowingly you know, new wave with these, you know, telekinetic, you know, or telepathic messages that are in the shapes of word forms on the page, and just, I mean, ooh, incredible stuff. And then, you know, they were doing this in the 50s, and, you know, people will come out with some of this stuff now and be like, look, it's clever and it's new. And like, we have no idea what we inherited from our progenitors and are just not paying any attention to, you know?
Yeah. I always think that I'm getting close to having read everything in a certain little subgenre, and then I talk to someone like you, and I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so much more to read.
Oh, I've just accepted that I'm perennially behind, and, you know, it's easier to make peace with what you're not reading that way.
Yeah. Well, and Dahlgren, at least, you know, it's 800 pages, mm-hmm. so the fact that I'm about halfway through and still have no idea exactly what's going on, kind of fits that definition where you think you're getting clues about something, and then it twists around, and maybe it's all in his head, or maybe they see different things, or
you know, that's very like Pynchonian, right? Like 49 or Gravity's Rainbow, when you start to think I may have understood that sentence, then it's completely destabilized, and you know, it's kooky writing.
You just kind of take out of it what you can.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
So what are you reading right now?
Right now I'm reading Don DeLillo's The Names. I don't really know how to summarize it for you. It was, it was his first published, 1982, I guess. And I was kind of guilty of not even knowing this was in his corpus. You know, I've read a lot of DeLillo, and I consider him an influence, and was just at the bookstore one day and saw this, and, you know, just goes to show you don't always know what you think you know about those you admire. But, yeah, it's, you know, DeLillo, he's sort of the plotless, you know, literary maestro who sort of brings this kind of heightened state of reality to interpersonal relationships. So, like, you know, the dialogue is very lyrical and sometimes abstract, and it doesn't always quite make a coherent conversation, but it has that feel of something organic and real, you know, that you might eavesdrop on or something like that. And that's sort of where he sings. Like, I don't know if you've read Underworld. That's one of his, you know, that's one of his best. It's a huge book, you know. It's got all kinds of, I hesitate to even tell you what it's about, because it's about so many things.
It's about New York.
Yeah, there you go. Fair enough. New York, you know. And maybe a little bit of baseball.
Yeah. But,
yeah, you know, you read that and you see these conversations and you wonder, like, that wasn't a real conversation, but it was fun and beautiful. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why I read DeLillo, is that he reminds me that, you know, not everything has to be, you know, reportage and fiction. You know, like, it can be, you know, stylized and strange and still be, you know, something, you know, something of an accomplishment, especially in a literary genre.
Mm-hmm. I think with him, I really noticed a change after whatever you want to call it, 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I read Falling Man, I think is what it's called.
Uh-huh.
It's all about that event. And then some of his writing right around then, it's like, he's working through it
in his
writing, but he kind of seems like he's gone back in the direction of what I think of when I think of him.
Yeah. I can't imagine not ever getting away from that. I mean, you know, I think 9/11 is going to be one of those, you know, one of those, worldly relevant events, which sounds a little, you know, Americocentric. I realize that, but
well, for us, that is our event.
Sure, you know, and it. But what I think is, it's going to be one of those, you know, period changing events. You know, like, there's usually something. Some king dies, or there's a great war, or there's a famine that marks the ends of particular, you know, literary movements. And postmodernism has been, you know, on top of the mountain for a long time. And I think that event and what it did to art and writing, you know, is going to be marked as a turning point, you know, later by, you know, smarter people than I who have time to study this sort of thing. But
you said it first.
Yeah. Be sure you submit this to the library. Give my credit.
Well, and since your novels both came after that, right?
Yeah.
So how do you think that changed what you wrote?
Definitely. I mean, before, well, let's see, I finished my first book in, I was 18. It was like, it was a long time ago, 97.
That's when it's not published, right?
Yeah, it's not published. And then I revised it for, you know, about 7 years. But that crossed over the 9/11 threshold. And that was a high fantasy, you know, with dragons and swords and, you know, epic plots and politics and everything. And then I guess it was in 2007. So, I mean, we'd all been kind of digesting 9/11 for a while. We're still living in the height of the age of terror, right? And I just did a complete about face, you know, wrote Noise, which is a third the length. It's broken. It's syntactically, you know, staccato. you know, there's not a lot of description or lyricality to it. And I just think that that kind of, I mean, I have to think that I kind of absorbed the same zeitgeist everybody else did, which was uncertainty and, you know, what about all the sort of like, you know, jingoistic sort of grand Americana dreams that especially people our age grew up with in the 80s, you know, which was, I mean, we were still riding really high on that momentum that started in the 50s, you know, of America on the peak, and kind of seeing that bubble sort of pop, realizing, you know, what can happen. And then around this, you know, not long after that, the economy started collapsing and people are still struggling with that. And I just didn't see that there was a lot of cheery material to write about. And
yeah.
We needed to spend some time thinking about this sort of stuff. And I certainly don't want to do it forever. The next book I'm working on, I hope, is the end of my dismal, navel-gazing, feel-bad books. But, you know, let's not put that on record just in case.
So do you have a sense of what this next book is about?
I do, yeah. This next book's weird, and it might really suck. So we'll see. I don't really know as I'm working on it, but it's called Totem. And it is about a fictional city-state somewhere in the world. It's not European. It's not Middle Eastern. It's not Western. And without going into too much detail, you know, this little place used to be the center of an empire. And the empire has shrunk, and the place has been occupied. It's been a territory of various kingdoms and nationalities, and they were finally given their independence, UNESCO World Heritage, all this sort of thing. But the problem is that this little city, this capital, all of the stone that it was carved from is radioactive. Much like some of our own rocks, you know, granite and things, they all have like low levels of radioactivity. But this little city-state air, the people who live there have a religious, you know, attachment to the stones of their city, and the rest of the world is helping them with like radiation abatement and providing food and water, and they become this little icon to watch in a fishbowl. The rest of the world watches them through this surveillance program called Worldview, which, you know, allows people to learn about this. What is the eighth wonder of the world in the book? And the story, what ends up happening, of course, is in a situation like that, you very quickly develop an apartheid state between those who are kind of registered to be a part of this pageantry and those who kind of just live and work there to keep them supported. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'm really looking at, you know, what radicalizes people and prepares them for acts of terrorism that some people think are revolution and some think are terrorism. And that's sort of what the book is about. It doesn't have the main characters. You never actually get inside their head. You just, they sort of pinball their way through the lives of a number of people in the city leading up to a very climactic event. And you watch the effects on the people who are just living in this city, you know, having their lives, and what happens to the two of them as they are, what happens to these people as those two main characters sort of stumble and bumble and connive and scheme their way up to their ultimate plan. So it's more of a documentary about this city with a whole bunch of characters. And that's why I say it might really suck.
Sounds really intriguing.
It might. So yeah, I wanted to look at apartheid and terrorism and, you know, nationality and, you know, kind of the ubiquity of surveillance and, you know, linkedness, you know, the idea that you could be Facebook friends with somebody who lives in this city and be like, hey, how's your radiation levels today? And they may rotate houses because some houses are more radioactive than others. You know, just the whole reality of what it'd be like to live in something like that. And it's a little bit of a satire, but only sort of, you know, just enough to give me a premise to write about.
You do like your revolutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. This should be the last of the dystopian cluster, and maybe I'll stop burning everything down every time I write a book.
Do you, I've always wondered, do you read and watch a lot of news to kind of inform all of this, or?
I used to read and watch a whole lot of it. I mean, before I came to work for the publishing company, I had a job writing for a video game studio, id Software. They've done Doom and Quake and, you know, a lot of video games that people are familiar with. And I wrote for them for 2 years. And so it was an hour to an hour and a half each way commute. And all I did was, you know, listen to news during that time. And then, you know, when I wasn't writing scripts, I was looking at news on the internet. And these days I'm a little less immersed to it. I've sort of pulled away from things like Facebook a little bit more and Twitter and things like that. And so, I rely a lot on my wife, who is way more plugged in than I am, but
yeah, she seems to be.
She is. Yeah. And I think, yeah, I think even just a few years of full like newsfeed immersion kind of is a good core sample that shows you what news is going to be like for the rest of your life. It's going to cycle through these kinds of periods. And so even if you aren't completely up to date, you have a general idea about how, you know, the world breathes, how it moves through these ups and downs. And so, yeah, that's I pulled away because I don't want to – the thing with Air is that it's the fictional city and totem. It could so easily – someone could so easily say, like, oh, I'm modeling that off of, you know, a Middle Eastern city or off of a Western or whatever. And I'm trying my very best to make it a non-place that is none of those things. And I don't want to be guilty of somebody thinking I'm attacking somebody when I'm really just exploring some ideas, you know.
Yeah. Well, it almost seems like if you immerse yourself – in it for so long, even 2 years, I think is a long time.
Yeah.
Writing is probably the good antidote, right?
Yeah.
Like just to get it back out and processed. Yeah. And I mean, I find I can't, I mean, I read the news in Twitter and sometimes in Facebook, like if people post things, but I'm guilty of not reading it otherwise. I just, it's too much to take.
I have a hard time too. Every time I find a news outlet that I like, I get about 6 months out of it before everybody realizes that they're biased this way or that, or that they're unreliable for this or that reason, and so you have to move on and find a new source. And
yeah,
you know, this sort of, you know, ongoing historiography just gets to be kind of tedious. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, that sounds like a really great project.
Yeah, I need to be done with it by May, so we'll see.
Seriously, May this year?
This May, yeah. Wow. I have a third of the way through it, I thought I would be better at being an editor and a writer at the same time. It takes a lot of time to be an editor. I mean, I don't even get to read submissions during the day. I mean, this is not a complaint that's unique to me. Any editor will tell you this, but, you know, work hours are not for reading the books that people want to sell you. Work hours are for working on what you've already bought. And so.
Oh, seriously? So you have to spend time outside of that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wow. If you're going to read anything, I actually get my most reading done when I go to conventions because I can take my Surface into the bar at the convention. And while I'm there, there are no projects for me to work on. There's nothing, you know, that's taking my attention. So I can just sit there and read, which is sort of ironic. But yeah, so between, you know, trying to read other people's books and then, you know, trying to keep up with kind of some of the books that you and I were just talking about and then trying to find your own time to write, it's I completely underestimated how much time that would take.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So since it's in this country, do you think you're going to go to – I don't remember the official name, Spokane Con or whatever WorldCon is this year.
WorldCon, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, my publisher tells me that I get to go. So
that's awesome.
Changes his mind. And, you know, our company is based not far from Spokane. Well, I say that. I have no idea the geography of Washington
State. It's far.
Okay, let's say. However far
Those Spokane, states are big.
That's how far they are. So yeah,
it's not as big as Texas, but...
So he claims that we're going. So I might show up. I would be excited to.
So do you have any? I don't know if maybe you don't want to say since you do this for a living, but do you have anything that you have worked on or brought into existence that you're particularly, I don't know, attached to, connected with? You know, not your own work, but the work that you've done as an editor. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I started acquiring. So last year, I came to the company in April. So right now, a lot of what's coming out is still what our publisher, Mark, had acquired before I got on board.
Oh, okay.
So I did do a lot of work on those titles, you know, like a lot of line editing and copy editing and such, but not so much developmental editing, not so much guiding the content. So the first book that I acquired is one of three. It's called Archangel. It's by a writer named Marguerite Reed. It comes out in May. And I couldn't be more excited about that book. That book is amazing. She writes it is a tough, gritty, it's not really a space opera. It's science fiction, ecological, terraforming, colonizing thrill ride. And it is told through the perspective. I mean, usually we get these stories through, you know, let's face it, it's usually a white guy who's pretty good with a ray gun.
Mm-hmm.
He's easy on the eyes and does okay with the ladies and all that kind of stuff. And that's fine. You know, those are fun for people who like that. But the protagonist in Archangel is a woman, a scientist, who's the only one on her planet licensed to use weaponry for reasons that you'll find out when you read the book. And she is struggling with grief and with basically PTSD, and she's now a single mother, and she has these responsibilities to this untamed paradisial world that they're trying to study as quickly as they can because – Earth is dying. They need a new home, and everyone wants to get there too fast. And if they come too fast, then they might kill the planet and ruin the whole thing. And so there's this huge pressure for colonization, and she's one of those who's trying to help the fight against early colonization, kind of defending this, you know, this paradise. And I mean, what's interesting about it, and the reason that it's jumped out to me and I wanted to buy it right away, was the world is really believable. It's very multicultural. So there are, you know, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, you know, Egyptian, I mean, the Coptic. There's all these different, you know, religions that are represented in a really realistic, non sort of contrived way. And it's really kind of cool to see that synthesized world now modeled as kind of the new paradise, right? So it doesn't belong to any one of these ideologies. It is kind of the amalgamation of them all. And who is it who is, you know, guiding the correct human interaction with this kind of stuff? Well, it's this highly educated, you know, kick-ass scientist, you know, who runs around studying basically dinosaurs, you know, and fights off a planetary invasion. You know, I mean, it's really good. It's really sophisticatedly written. It'll really appeal to people who like stuff like, you know, like Firefly, Star Trek, you know, both old and new generation, fans of Anne Leckie. I mean, anyway, yeah, I could go on about that.
Yeah, no, it sounds good.
Yeah.
It's so exciting to be involved at that.
Oh yeah. Way. Yeah. That book is all done. Marguerite is a big talent. That book is all done. And, it comes out in May. So she's busy working on her next one. I've got one that I'm that just recently acquired, the first of another trilogy called The World Mender Trilogy by Matthew Kressel. His first book, King of Shards, comes out this fall, and we're actively working on this right now. But his is a really cool – I call it contemporary fantasy because it's not swords and elves, and it's not like vampires and werewolves, so it's not really urban. It's not really high. It's I think of it more as contemporary fantasy, and it takes as its premise a lot of the ideas of like Judaic – cosmology, like, you know, exploring what that means for the universe and multiple dimensions, and where did the origination of you know, a lot of the Hebraic Abrahamic belief systems come from. And but it merges our world with these places, you know, that are occupied by demons and angels, these other dimensions that it kind of slips back and forth through. And it's just this really cool, really well-paced epic fantasy about saving the universe from annihilation that uses, you know, mysticism as its entry into the fantastic. And like I said, that comes out in the fall. That one is a real page turner. I just reread it the other day, and it was even better this time than last. So those two are you know, firmly in genre. Really excited about those. I've got another one that also comes out this fall called We Dream of Water, by a mutual acquaintance of ours, Sinogen Smajic.
Wow.
Yeah, it comes out this fall. I read that book years ago. I loved it. I believed in it. I wrote a letter to my agent. He signed Citizen I think the next week. And then I just struggled to find a publisher for it because some were claiming it was too literary to be noir, and some were saying it was too noir to be literary. And, you know, the point, damn it, is that it is literary noir.
Yeah, no kidding. We're so tired of these boxes.
Yeah. It's a post-Katrina sex, drugs, and bad decisions sort of novel, and there's a conspiracy, and there's a mystery to be solved. And, you know, that was one of the best things I've ever read. You know, I think I told Surgeon when I read it that my favorite novel was The Grapes of Wrath, and that this was probably my second favorite novel.
High praise.
Yeah. And it's short and punchy. And, I mean, to be fair, it's in that dirty clipped mode that I used in Noise and Chimpanzee. So I may be kind of not impartial about it, but,
well, then maybe they can hire you to read the audiobook.
Hey, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's funny because I know this is like completely on a tangent, but you say short and clippy, and
yeah,
I had listened to your audio play for Chimpanzee,
right?
And you did most of the narrating, and if it was just your voice worked really well in that, so yeah, if his book is like that, then maybe he can hire you.
Yeah, you know, that was kind of by necessity when we were doing that one. I had actors lined up for everything else, but the narration and the dialogue of the main character, which was so much based on my own like life and experiences, would have taken so long to find somebody to do it appropriately, and it would have been such an unfair request because that took so much time to do that we just decided it was better if I just read it myself. You know, luckily, it seems to have worked out.
Yeah, so you produced, or someone you know produced, the audio play version of your second novel, Chimpanzee.
Yeah.
So how long did that take? How did that come about?
Oh man, that was so, from the publishing end, when you sell things to some of the better known audiobook producers and distributors, you usually do it in blocks. So we'll sell them 5 or 6 titles at a time. We sell them the audio rights, right?
Oh, okay.
And often they just buy them. You know, like, great, you know, send us the manuscripts when they're done. And that happened for us at Underland, the publisher of Chimpanzee. And we turned it in, and I was already pretty nervous before we turned it in because, I mean, you've read it. There's weird gaps in the text, and there's...
Yeah. That's the point, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's foreign languages that aren't translated, and I remember thinking, like, they are not going to like this. and sure enough, we turned it in, and they were like, we don't like this. So we gave them their money back, and they gave us the rights back. And, I mean, they were cool about it. They just, like, we don't know how to produce this, right? This is too weird. And so Mark, the publisher, you know, got the note, and he was like, yeah, no problem, send it back. And he had come down here for a visit to where I live in Denton, which is a, you know, this is a college town. We have 2 colleges, a big art scene, lots of music, performance, everything else. And he just kind of got to see some of the local color and met some of people that I know, a lot of whom were professional voice actors and actresses. And before he left, before he gets on the plane to go home, he says, I got an idea. Why don't you just do Chimpanzee as an audio play and we'll produce it ourselves and then we'll distribute it on our own. And so I said, okay. He got off the plane, and the way he tells the story, by the time he got off the plane, I had already cast half of the people and had a production schedule. So, yeah, I partnered up with a friend of mine, Grady Sandlin, who runs a recording outfit called Great Room Studios, and he agreed to do all of the recording and engineering, and he cut us a real sweetheart deal on that. I mean, did us a huge favor. So he and I sort of co-produced it. I did the audio design, you know, that is finding all the Foley sounds and securing the music and in many cases creating sound effects and stuff. And he made sure that it was all stitched together properly and, you know, all of that audio engineer stuff that I don't understand.
Yeah, but, I thought it was great.
Yeah.
And you used local musicians, right?
I did, yeah. You know, like I said, this is a really big music town. And I just put out a call on Facebook that said what we were doing, and if anybody had music that wanted to be featured, please just let me know. And I got so many responses that I couldn't use more than about a third of it.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, the actors and actresses were the same way. You know, they volunteered and they picked out the roles they wanted, and they all took direction really well. And I think Grady and I each put in about 100 hours before we recorded everyone. And then, you know, about another 100 hours polishing it all up in the end. So it was kind of – and we had a deadline. We wanted to get it done by the time that the book was going to be released, which was in, geez, I don't even remember, September or October or something like that.
Hmm.
And so we were, I think I got the mastered CDs from him a day before the release party. And it was the weekend before, and I spent the weekend hand burning all the discs. And Mark, our publisher, and Misty, my coworker, were here, and we hand stenciled the discs, and I had designed up an insert, and we hand stapled it. I mean, the entire thing was our, what would we call it? Artisanal audio. But yeah, we got it all done in time and got them up there. And we then sent the copy back to the original folks who had a hard time with how to produce it. And they were fine with it. They took it right away, and now they're helping us distribute it. It's just...
Oh, that's good. Like an Audible or things like that.
Yeah, it just had to be... it couldn't be done as a regular audiobook. It needed some tricks to sort of help you listen your way through some of the weird stuff in the book, you know?
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at my hand stenciled version.
Yes.
I didn't realize. Wow, it's my artisanal audiobook there.
Yeah, 100% all natural.
We're going to stop for a minute and listen to a 3-minute excerpt from the audio play version of Chimpanzee. This comes from Chapter 9.
We have to balance our goods in teetering stacks in the parking lot. Some of the other people came prepared. They have dollies and repurposed luggage wheelers, outfitted with plastic crates and bungee cords. We are careful, moving with the Exodus toward our car. Serene says something about the savings, about the auction next week. There are 2 men arguing over a box of produce, 5 parking spaces over from ours. Each of them has his fingers laced through the ventilation holes in the box. The trunk of the minivan behind them lights their foreheads. I let Serene arrange our things. I hand them to her and watch the argument. People are ignoring the men, even in the adjacent spaces.
Ben!
I turn to look at her. Behind me, gunshots erupt. Loud ones. A handgun with a short muzzle. A revolver, maybe. Serene squats, her hands upon her ears. I see her pivot on the balls of her feet, left, right. She's unsure what to do. People are screaming, footfalls slapping. I feel the thundering herd against my shoulders. Fear is one of our most primary emotions. It is the clash of reflex, instinct, muscle memory against the social self, which is the hesitation to ignore one's better sense, one's sleeping self, because this is civilization after all. There are no predators in the savanna grass here. Nothing to be afraid of. There is only one man behind the minivan now. The trunk canopies him. The interior light now reveals very little. He is on the pavement. His fingers still grasp the overturned box. Its lid is sealed with packing tape. There are more shots, not far away. Screaming. I feel that pressure behind my eyes, like the simulation. Those fists upon my spine. The urge, the dominant impulse that the goggles have taught me to resist, to crave. I want to give in. Do what a man should do. I am a pump. Fear and light and instinct trapped by the valves in my bloodstream.
Ben!
I want to open those valves, to destroy them with some adrenal blast. I want to release the tide and watch it rain for 40 days.
Ben, please!
I allow my sense of self to rearrange itself from higher to lower scalar orders. It creates the illusion of control, so I can do what a man does, despite my immediate fear. I run through the jostling crowd. There are people standing around the victim, staring, some at the box of produce. He isn't moving. I dig my fingers into his neck, but I can't tell. His pulse or mine? There's nothing about him doing any of the things that look like living. What are the clues? I can't remember. My pants sponge his blood where my knees touch the pavement. I'm not in control here. My bloodstream is moving things along in pressurized bursts, clenching and sealing and flowing away. I am only the flotsam of my fluid self. Other people are touching him now, too, laying on hands and palming blood and being part of the process. None of us are good at it. Someone grabs the box of produce. He isn't one of us, down here, being together in the blood. He doesn't get very far before I bloodstream him to the ground and face against the concrete. I'm only good enough at it, because it is difficult to grasp his head with so much blood between my fingers. Serene's sudden hands are cool on my neck, hard and deep into my windpipe, and we're halfway back to the car, and I'm surprised. She makes me set down the dead man's box of produce. I dumb grabbed it, getting up. Maybe, I don't know. Someone else carries it immediately away. There is a traffic jam exiting the parking lot. Serene drives.
Okay, our podcast continues. I accidentally deleted a little bit, but I basically asked Darren what he was going to be reading next.
Daryl Gregory's After Party.
Mm-hmm.
That comes really highly recommended. I think I met him long enough to shake his hand at World Fantasy this year, and then we were just kind of pulled two different directions. I really wanted to talk to him about it, but I'm going to read that.
Does it have a red cover?
It does have a red cover. There's a yellow pill on the front of it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I haven't read that, but it's on my list.
Yeah, I'm about three chapters in, and, you know, so I guess technically I've started it, but, yeah, I need to finish it. I'm going on vacation tomorrow, so I'll take it with you.
Ooh, exciting.
Yeah, let's see. What do I have on my shelf? I still need to read Ready Player One. That's up there.
Hmm.
Let's see. Jack O'Connell's Word Made Flesh. Believe it or not, I've never read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, so I'm reading that this year. It's sitting over there in the to-read pile.
Huh, that's like a 70s classic, right? I haven't ever read it either.
It is, yeah. And, you know, then there's, after that, I kind of want to do this thing where I sort of, de-Westernize a bit, you know, like I said, my wife and I are working on that sort of global multicultural journal, and she has all these fantastic novels by non-Western writers, you know, Arabic, South African, North African, that are just sitting around here, and she's always telling me how great they are. And I have no idea about any of these people, and I don't know anything about this mode. And I kind of feel like I should just read 20 or so of them, you know, and kind of just try to blow my mind a little bit and open some horizons. So that's probably what I'll do after I get through the three or four that are on my plate. But like,
that's great.
I'm trying not to buy new books, but you know, how that goes.
I have a room full of books that wish I wouldn't buy new books. Yeah. Yeah.
What's on your to read plate?
Goodness. I'm reading right now. I've started it. It's The Desert Solitaire.
Okay.
By Edward Abbey. It's about the Moab Desert
Cool.
Arches National Park. He worked there for one season as a park ranger. It's kind of this classic, I've just never read it, kind of the beginnings of the environmental eco movement. And he talks in the beginning about how don't go try to find this park, because how I've written about it doesn't exist anymore. It's already been, you know, paved over. And
Yeah,
but it's, I mean, the descriptions are beautiful. I've never been to that area of the country except for driving across in a moving van. So it's really making me want to go there.
I can imagine.
And I'm reading a lot of books from Oceania this year. And so I've been reading books in New Guinea.
Oh, cool.
Late this month, and then I'll move on to a different country. Because I'm kind of like you. Like, I feel like most of my reading is American or English authors, and I'm always trying to kind of push myself outside of that. So I have actually asked Rima a few times for author recommendations. A few of those are on my shelf right now, probably.
Yeah. she is a good one to ask. She is just brimming with recommendations.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
But lots of good stuff. I just always... Yeah, my to-read list is how I'm going to live forever, basically.
we all have our to-read lists, and those are just kind of fantasies. And then we have like our, hey, I'm actually going to read this list.
Right, the book I have sitting next to me right now.
If you can touch it, then maybe you know. If not, then it doesn't exist.
Yeah, and I hear this Darren Bradley book's coming out.
That's the idea. But if I do it on time, you still have till, it won't come out till 2016, so.
Yeah, so... Once you finish, May, is that like a deadline for draft number one?
Yeah, that's an internal, well, it's not really draft. Well, I suppose you could think of it that way. When I turn it in, and this is common for most publishing houses, and I don't know if this would be of interest to your audience or not, but when you sell a book, you usually have an amount of time between when you sell it and when you have to turn it in, so to speak. Even if you think it's done, like, hey, I wrote a book and they bought it, that's great. There's this 6-month window. I learned this the hard way in my first book. And during that time is when you're supposed to get it into what you think of as your best shape. Maybe it's a month, maybe it's 6 months. I remember with Noise, I didn't know that. And so we sold it like in May, and it was technically due in November. And I remember reading the contract one day. This is like October, right? And I'm like, what does this do in November stuff? And so I write to my editor. It was Juliet Ullman at the time at Bantam. And I'm like, hey, I don't get it. What's this November thing? And she's like, well, that's when you have to turn in your final version of the book. And I said, well, you know, I mean, it is final. I wrote it. You bought it. And, you know, she very patiently, you know, told me. She's like, well, yes, but this is the time period when you're supposed to be fixing it and getting it ready for me. And there was just kind of a moment of, okay.
Oh, so, no.
Yeah, so you finish it up real quick. You turn it in. And then your editor will get a hold of it, you know, write you a letter with changes. You revise it. And then it kind of goes back and forth through this production timeline, which I could talk you through, but it's probably a little bit boring. But so in May, I'm supposed to turn in what I think is my done version. All I can do is not think about May and just keep thinking about the chapter I'm working on. You know?
Well, it's kind of like being in a band, right? You write the song, you like the song, and then you sing it for a few people and you take it to a few of your shows and then you make a recording and then you go on tour. So by the time you're done with that song, you're probably just over it completely.
I think you're so right, and most people don't realize that. I mean, there is such a machined, almost unnatural process behind getting a book out. Like, I can remember, I'm sure some of your aspiring writer listeners might be guilty of this too. And I've advised against it before when I've given public talks, but you're writing a book, right? You want to get it done, and you're, you know, looking for inspiration, whatever else, and you go grab off the bookshelf a copy of your favorite author's latest novel, right? And you read two or three pages, and you close it, and you get pissed off because, man, you're never going to write that well. You know what I mean? Like what am I even doing here?
Yeah, what's the point?
and what, you know, what I didn't know then when I was doing that, I was maybe a kid, like 19, and what other people don't know too is this writer finishes a book, right? He or she reads it and a couple of times to themselves, makes changes, turns it in. The editor gets it. He or she reads it, makes changes, turns it in. The copy editor gets a hold of it. Copy editor goes through and fixes all your mistakes. By this time, as an author, you've read this book probably 8 or 9 times, and you really are not enjoying it anymore. I mean, it's work. You're looking at, you know, at details. You're not really kind of seeing the singing of the project anymore. And then by the time it finally gets out, it gets bound. There's a cover artist who gets involved, and then there are marketing people who help talk it up, and there are book reps who make sure that it gets into the bookstores, and then there are bookstore owners who make sure that they sell it to you appropriately, and then there are reviewers that anyway, there's this small army of machine pegs with, you know, square pegs and round holes that kind of work to get that product in your hand that you then open up and say, oh crap, I don't write as well as this person. And that's such a myth, because you don't write as well as that
team.
Yeah. I mean, even the author you're reading doesn't write as well as that team of professionals. They didn't write that well in the beginning. It had to be brought up to that stage.
Right. And so then after that, after all those years, because it is years, then you have to start worrying about what people think about it. Or do you?
You know, I think you do at first. I mean, I cared a lot about what people thought about Noise, my first book. You know, the first books are a big deal. In order to sell subsequent books, you know, unfortunately, these days, it's largely an accounting game. You know, like, how well did you sell before, and what was your markets, and how were your reviews? And, you know, if you completely flop, you can really hurt your career, you know, and it can be hard to get back up. And so with Noise, I really did care a lot, you know, and I watched and I read. And I noticed that I tended to get two types of reviews. I got these five-star, you know, laudatory, you know, things nominating me for Nobel Prizes. And then I got these one-star, like, what the hell is this crap, you know? And, it kept kind of happening, and I sort of realized that I kind of liked that, because who wants to be a three-star kind of person? You know what
right.
I mean? You don't want to be like, yeah, that was a book. That happened. You know, like, I just experienced that. That's all I have to say about it.
At least hatred is a feeling.
Yeah, you want it to be really pissed off or be really great. And that has carried through into the types of reviews that I get with Chimpanzee, and I'm pretty sure that that's what Toto was going to get too. And I don't care as much now. I don't really read reviews like I used to. I mean, I read them long enough to send them on to my publisher and pull a blurb and tell my friends, like, look, this is great. They think I'm smart and funny. But I don't keep up with, like, what's being said on Goodreads or what people are saying on Twitter. I try to just enjoy those services as they are without being too hung up. And I think everybody kind of gets to that stage. There's a lot of fuss and bother, and you worry, and how's my career going to go? And then it kind of just keeps happening, and you realize, oh, well, this is you know, the noise that accompanies, pardon the pun there, the noise that accompanies a project like this. And you learn to get thick skin, and, you know, because, I mean, you're already working on your next project, and you really don't give a crap about the one that they're reviewing, because, man, you're done with it. You know what I mean? Like, mentally, you're just checked out, and you hope it does well, but good grief, please don't make me read it again, you know? But you have to keep reading it, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I always wondered about that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be really hard with how everything is online and just so easily accessible.
Yeah, I mean, all you got to do is Google yourself, and it'll all pop up. If you really want to ruin your day, you know, you can do that, but. And I'm fortunate too, because you know Google Alerts, right? Everybody's got Google Alerts, and my Google Alert is kind of stupid. Like, it doesn't find things, and, like, I have a couple different versions of it, and every now and then I'll be like, yeah, sure, let me check out. Did anybody say anything? And I'll Google it. I'll be like, look at all of this stuff. You know, like, my Google Alert thing didn't find any of it, and so mine's either kind of stupid, or it's, like, really empathic and kind of caring, and it's like, listen, you don't need to see these five things. Here's the one thing you should see. And so, yeah, I mean, I have it, and it points out, just it lets me know every time a library acquires a copy, which is really uplifting.
Oh, yeah.
But it doesn't tell me anytime somebody reviews something, which I guess is its weird way of being, you know, encouraging. So
yeah, I'll just focus on purchases.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like, look at all these libraries. It's great. And, like, Google Alerts, like, see, you're doing so well.
Yeah, and the libraries will keep them for good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you had mentioned that you had some upcoming events, maybe, or some talks.
I got a couple things coming up.
Did you want to mention those?
Sure. On the 11th of February, the people at my alma mater, University of North Texas, have invited me to do a reading. And so I'll be reading I should have written it down. It's at 7:30 on the UNT campus. There's a flyer at engl.unt.edu. And that's just going to be a reading and signing. I'll have copies of both of my books for sale, you know, just kind of shaking hands, kissing babies, that kind of thing.
Cool.
And then I've got another event at the end of March. There's, like, a 3-day literary arts festival here locally at Richland College. And I'll be reading and speaking kind of about some of the stuff we've been talking about today, you know, publishing and editing and what to expect. And then I'll do a little dog and pony show. And, you know, hopefully a few people might want to. I want to pick up a copy of what I have there, but yeah, I've got those two things lined up, and that's probably the last that I'll do for Chimpanzee, unless you know, there's the Texas Book Festival, which would be, you know, that'd be great to go to if that comes through, then I'll attend that too. But other than that, I think I'll probably be done promoting Chimpanzee at that point, because that would have been, you know, 8 or 9 months, and
yeah,
you just can't really sustain the interest in it that long.
You know? Yeah, you just kind of do the circuit. Mm-hmm. You know, I've started going to our South Carolina Book Festival over here, and I just love that, because meeting the authors that live locally, it feels like you really get to know them, and
yeah,
it's a good fan base, I guess.
Yeah, those things are fun, you know. I mean, pretty much every state has a pretty good one that's worth attending, so.
Yeah, that's great.
Where's the one in South Carolina, Hill? Is that in Columbus?
It's in Columbia.
Yeah.
But that's only like a 2-hour drive, so.
Yeah, not so far.
And then the authors all seem to kind of know each other, so that's a nice community, I think.
Oh, no kidding.
I mean, South Carolina is a small state, but.
I remember, I was there.
Yes, you were. Still small.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.